And hello, listeners. Welcome to 105.1 WBNH, Business IQ Radio here. I'm Don Byrne, one of your hosts, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Andrea O'Brien. Hello, Andrea.
Hey, Don. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. I think this is going to be a very interesting show today. We were able to find a guest with all the controversy going on around Bitcoins and blockchain.
Crazy. It's crazy.
And I don't think, I don't understand it.
And that amazes me because you kind of have a technology background. And I can tell you that I definitely don't understand it. And I wonder how many of our listeners are, you know, sure, we've all heard about the new surge in Bitcoin and how it's increased in value 1,000-fold.
Right.
And maybe even feel like you've missed out on that wave and like, should I jump in now or not? You know what? If I don't understand it, I'm not doing it.
Well, somebody called it the new gold rush. And if you remember, if you see the cases of the gold rush, what they found was the people who made the money were not the people using the picks and shovels. It was the people selling the picks and shovels to the miners.
Ah.
You know, that's the creation of businesses like Levi Strauss with durable jeans that could stand up to the hardy work. It wasn't the people that were out looking for the lost Dutchman's mind.
You know, so I wonder, who are those people today in the Bitcoin hunt?
Well, I think the other aspect, I hope we get a chance to talk about, there's so much to cover. I'd like to get into a little bit of the fraud stuff, but I want to ask you, now you are a business expert, you're a business advisor for the Small Business Administration.
SBDC, Small Business Development Center.
That's right, okay. And you do business and you support hundreds of clients, literally, helping people become successful. So I have a couple of business questions I want to ask you.
Okay.
If I were to ask you, what do you think the business of the following company is? Please tell me what you think it is.
Okay.
It's called Long Blockchain Corporation.
What do I think they do?
Yeah.
I think, well, I don't know. I'm guessing they build children's building blocks.
Well, you're not far off. It turns out that this is a company that 4 weeks ago was known as the Long Island Iced Tea Company, and when they changed their name, they're a microcap company. When they changed their name to the Long Blockchain Company, their stock went up 290% in a week.
Get out.
How about No Chain Inc.? What do you think that company does for a business?
I think they fix bike chains.
No, they're a e-cigarette company, and they changed their name, and their stock jumped hugely in value.
Chain smoking. Yeah.
Here's the last one, Riot Blockchain.
Riot Blockchain. I think they make cement barricades.
No, they're a biometric company. Their original name before they changed it about a month ago was Bioptics. And once again, they experienced a several 100% increase just by changing the name.
Change the name of the show.
You're exactly right. So this is going to, in the future, be known as Blockchain Biz or something like that.
Right.
Biz
or
Blockchain. Or
Blockchain Radio.
Blockchain Radio and go up. But it just shows some of the...
Cha-ching. That's our new theme song.
Cha-ching, right. So I think it shows some of the great interest that's around this concept. And it's been referred to as the...
It's a frenzy. I feel like it's almost a frenzy.
And, you know, people talk about the analogy to the tulip frenzy that took place in the 1700s that just, you know, had people buying tulip seeds or, I guess, bulbs. And overnight, vast fortunes disappeared. People put their entire...
So who's our guest?
So our guest is Sharon Sargent. She is an investigative reporter and a forensic genealogist. Her company is Ancestral Manor, and we're going to have to invite her in to tell us a bit about what's going on there. So actually, with no further ado, why don't we invite her in and ask you to welcome her.
Hey, Sharon. Thank you so much for coming on our BizIQ radio show. And before we dive into the topic, which excitingly is Bitcoin and BitChain and how the story came out about the inventor, we'd like to hear about your background and how you became involved in helping with that Newsweek story.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they were looking for somebody to help them do some investigative work. Do you have a background in this?
First of all, I have decades of experience in networks and security. So it was an unusual combination.
A technology background.
That's right.
And I think if I remember, you're looking at your resume, you also, some of that was involved with the early startup days of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
And machine learning, which all obviously very topical these days.
Right. So my career for 30 years was in technology and systems engineering, but networks and security. So the 20 years ago, I became involved in family history research, which morphed into forensic genealogy, which actually deals with legal aspects, monetary aspects, things that are not your normal family history.
So when you say monetary aspects, my understanding, and I know a little bit about this, is that genealogists sometimes are involved in helping find people when there are wills that are unfulfilled and there are bequeaths to people.
Right. Yeah. Finding heirs is the sort of the best known forensic genealogy application, because it's gone on for years and it can involve mineral rights and, you know, all kinds of things. But there are other aspects of forensic genealogy. For example, I've worked on cases for Providence verifying the background and trail on an object that has value.
There's a stagecoach, I think you told me about, right?
Right.
You were tracking down to see if it was a fraudulent replica or a real antique.
Well, the usual forensics, for example, on an object, have their limitations. I was able to prove that this particular stagecoach was is still the earliest surviving Concord coach from 1848.
Who asks those questions? I mean, who comes forward?
The owner of that stagecoach.
Oh, they want to know if it's authentic.
Right.
Because it impacts the value.
He had physical evidence in the coach itself, but some of the quote-unquote stagecoach experts argued with him.
Hmm.
So he actually hired me to research it. And what solved that case was mail contracts. And
M-A-I-L.
That's right.
Okay.
M-A-I, right.
This is a family show.
I know. In any case, so there was a paper trail that went along with the physical, you know, physical object.
So you're good at piecing clues and evidence together to come up with an answer.
Right. And that actually comes from the technology background, because that's what I was doing in technology.
Now, I think you also are well known for helping solve a fraudulent case where somebody had claimed to be a Holocaust survivor, was defrauding people of a lot of money, and you were able to show that this individual was not who they claimed to be. Am I getting that story right?
Yes. Misha DiFonseca is the first Holocaust fraud that I uncovered. There's two elements to a Holocaust fraud. The first one is that it damages the credibility of real Holocaust survivors, who I happen to know.
I do some, as well. Yeah.
Yeah. But also that using such a horrific event to get money from other people is a terrible fraud. So that was, I solved three cases with Holocaust frauds, not the kind of case that I like to take. But because of the first one, I got asked to do two others.
And then you got propelled into somehow meeting up with some people at Newsweek.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the recognition for having some expertise with Holocaust frauds prompted a journalist who was not yet working for Newsweek to ask me to research something for her book, because she was writing about oil markets, and the main character in the oil market story claimed that his mother was a Holocaust survivor. And somebody said to her, you better check this out, because he's a central figure in the story. And not only was I able to confirm that his mother was a real Holocaust survivor, but I was able to give him information that he didn't have. So that was a positive case. In any case, the journalist, Leah McGrath Goodman, was the author of that book. And at that time, she was working for various financial organizations as a journalist. And then worked on another story with her. And when Newsweek decided they were going to try to find out who the creator of Bitcoin was, she asked me to work on it.
How important at this point was Bitcoin, you know, on the market, or even, you know, on the black market? Or
it was early 2014. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different, the Bitcoin market began actually in 2009. The first transaction between Satoshi Nakamoto and Hal Finney.
Who is the alleged?
Alleged.
Proven or alleged?
Well, to me, it's proven.
Okay.
But other people don't agree.
Okay, so alleged inventor.
Exactly.
Well, and I think it's more complicated than that, because it's not clear that there really is an individual by that name, right?
Oh, no. This person, Satoshi, now known as Dorian Nakamoto, was born Satoshi Nakamoto in Japan.
And did you help identify this individual?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I remember listening to the NPR story on this topic, and I think they interviewed him for the story.
That may be. He denied, for all the media, he denied that he knew anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
He denied.
Why would he deny it? Was his life in jeopardy? I mean,
actually, that is a potential component.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, he has bitcoins that are probably valued at like $800 million right now.
Well, here's the one of the twists, whether anyone agrees that he was the inventor or a part of a group that invented Bitcoin. He recently cashed in Bitcoins that were given to him in sympathy, because people who owned Bitcoins believed that he had been wrongly accused. So they gave him, I think the number was something like 65 Bitcoins.
Oh my goodness.
In 2014. Now, 65 Bitcoins is worth a bit more than it was in 2014. He cashed those in last summer.
Well, that was too bad.
Well, it was still almost 300,000, I think, at the time. The number that comes to mind is 270,000.
I feel like we're getting ahead of ourselves just a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So let's go back to that time when, so you're working on this Newsweek story, mm-hmm. trying to figure out who the person is who came up with this. I would call it a notion. I mean, I'm still not sure what exactly.
It's a cryptocurrency. Right. So it's.
Let's talk about that. So what is Bitcoin?
Well,
I know it's a cryptocurrency, but.
Yeah, cryptocurrencies have been at play at least since the 1980s, where people have been trying to come up with an electronic currency.
They just made it up, and somebody, decides. I hear what you're saying, but what is it? How does it manifest itself?
Well, the key to Bitcoin is the blockchain concept. And the blockchain concept is a way of keeping the ledger of all the transactions that have ever transpired in an accessible way, and updating them only if you get the concurrence of disparate computer systems. So the idea is that if a transaction is placed and that transaction does not get concurrence from all of the computers that are participating in sharing that information, then it won't be completed. So the blockchain concept is a security kind of thing. And the motivation, and this is seen in Satoshi Nakamoto's original, the 2009 version of his white paper, is it's a libertarian concept. That it was spawned in 2007 and 2008 when we had a massive banking problem.
Right.
So the idea was that you can't rely on a central system because of all the issues with the central system and manipulation and so on. So the blockchain concept is actually very simple and elegant.
One question I have is, where does the money go? Where does the money go when someone invests in a Bitcoin? Is there a central bank or some other?
There are markets, and Bitcoin's not the only cryptocurrency, but it is the one that
spawned
all the others.
What are some others that we might?
I can't even think of all the...
Ripple is one.
Yeah.
Sandcoin, right? Glasscoin.
There's Bitcoin Lite. There's...
Doggy.
I hadn't even heard of that one.
Doge, yeah. Some people pronounce it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the... what you have to realize is it's a speculative market. Now, money systems are full of speculation also. So you can see valuations of monetary systems that change. But this is highly speculative system.
And they feel like, and the person who conceived this feels as though it's more predictable or more secure than what we experienced in 2008,
Well, there are millions of people who think that.
Yeah. because it's just slightly out of touch, but it's just beyond the grasp of those that would want to manipulate the economics of, our country. Is that?
Well,
everything can be manipulated. Except
that in the case of Bitcoin, the transactions it's a bit like going to Las Vegas and gambling,
right?
In my opinion,
sure.
All right, so that's why it's speculative and it's volatile. I don't know what the status is today about how much value has been lost in the last week or two on Bitcoin. It was way up.
It was up to 20,000 and dropped to about 15,000.
I think it's less than that now.
And then, I think it keeps going. I mean, it's like a commodity, like buying pork bellies. You're speculating in the future.
Right, but where does... I understand that when you buy a pork belly, there's money that comes out of your account and it goes to a company you're buying shares of a company, so the company gets the money and you get...
Right, and you have to have... You want to explain what a wallet is, maybe a crypto wallet, and how
that's what I don't get.
The security problems end up in the exchanges. There's multiple Bitcoin exchanges where you can deposit Bitcoins and get cash. And now what happened early on was because it was this different marketplace, there was lots of black market types of things, you know, going on. And but a wallet is when you create Bitcoins and you hold them, you have a key. And that's where the cryptology comes in. So nobody can get the coin out of the big ledger of all the transactions without that key. But the problem with the security has been in the exchanges, because the software in the exchanges is vulnerable, like today, every kind of software, every kind of database is being hacked all the time.
Sure.
So in any case, the and the wallets have the same vulnerability. But as far as I know, the blockchain itself has never been compromised.
So let me ask you a question, see if I can understand this a little bit. This is what they call a fiat currency, which says it has no intrinsic value. It's like the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is no longer backed by gold or silver. It's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government.
Right.
That's the only guarantee we have. That's the only thing that brings value to our currency. And so someone has said, for Bitcoins, I will accept your Bitcoin in exchange for a product or a service.
Mm-hmm.
And in their acceptance of that, they transfer value to mm-hmm. the currency. And what happens is that people are saying, oh, well, we're willing to do this. And the other unique thing, my understanding of the Bitcoin or I think of all the cryptocurrencies, is that you don't have the ability to have inflation because there's a limited number of these that will ever exist. There's no way to have an inflation take place. I mean, a lot of people were concerned with the Federal Reserve printing a lot of money, U.S. money, and in terms of the valuation, the currency exchange, U.S. dollar, you know, buying less and less euros at one point in time or worth fewer and fewer Swiss francs, that doesn't happen from an increase in the number or the
Correct.
Size of the money
mm-hmm.
supply, because there's a limited number of coins. And that's what people are doing with this concept of mining. They're trying to extract the few final coins that are out there. So it's a limited supply, and people are willing to accept it. And as they accept it, they're willing to trade upward or downward. And that's where the volatility comes from, is in terms of their speculation, what it's worth. I mean, I remember when I first looked at these, they were trading at about $200 a coin. And as we've just said, they're trading, you know, somewhere in the area of, they have traded 100, as high as,
yeah,
yeah, exactly, $20,000.
For those of us who are not versed in all this technology, I mean, these are virtual coins. Why can't you make more?
The blockchain.
Because of the blockchain. What Don mentioned is there are only so many.
But who says?
Like Satoshi Nakamoto.
Okay.
That's part of the white paper, you know, premise. All right. So treating it like it's gold.
Time to hear the story then.
Yeah. Well, let me try to answer this.
I feel like the emperor has no clothes here. I'm just saying.
Well, that's a lot of people feel that. I mean, imagine the following. If I said to you, hey, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to find every prime number between 1 and 100. Now, a prime number is a number that's only divisible by itself in the number 1. So you would go through and you would test numbers and you'd say, oh, number 4, well, that's divisible by 2, that's not a prime number. 6, oh, that's divisible by 3 and 2, that's not a prime number. 7, oh, only divisible by itself in 1. So I found one. So they have mathematical formulas that you have to have computers that are running to do calculations. And when they hit certain goals that are set up in this, defined in this white paper, you get a coin. You're granted a coin. You found one of the coins. And when you find it, you get ownership of that coin. You've mined it. And that's what they're talking about in mining. Mm-hmm. Am I sort of on
yes.
point with that?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Will my computer do it automatically? Or do I have to ask it a certain...
No, you. There are now, I think, four companies that are applying supercomputers to running the algorithms to find these because it's a race. If somebody else finds it first, it's taken.
Okay.
So,
and even back in the day, the beginning of Bitcoin in 2009, when Satoshi Nakamoto was testing this, his first exchange was with Hal Finney, who was a true cryptographer. He's since died, unfortunately, of ALS. And Hal Finney was real interested, not only because he was a cryptographer, but because he had tried to create his own cryptocurrency, and it didn't take off. So he saw the advantages of what Satoshi Nakamoto did. And the very first exchange with Satoshi Nakamoto and Bitcoins was between he and Hal Finney. And what's really interesting, and this is not something that people pay enough attention to, there's a dump file, which is the program crashed in this exchange between Satoshi Nakamoto and Hal Finney. And Hal Finney was anxious to help him debug the software, so he posted that dump file on a
bulletin board,
exactly, where people were discussing and exchanging ideas and information about Bitcoin. It's still there, as far as I know, today. And it gives the IP addresses of three computers. And one was definitely Hal Finney's. You can tell where they were located. And one was located right near Dorian Nakamoto. And the third one was what they call a listener, because you always need a computer who's listening to facilitate the blockchain exchanges.
Hmm.
So
it's an arbitrator in some sense, right?
It's like
a voting of it's real or it's not real.
It's part of the design that there always needs to be a listener. But in any case, an arbitrator is probably a good way to think of it. But in any case, the as time went on, Hal Finney was really interested in helping Satoshi Nakamoto, and he actually introduced some code that improved the cryptology because Satoshi Nakamoto was no crypto expert. He used a black box publicly available. And Hal Finney made some enhancements, and he mined Bitcoins. But he had to stop mining Bitcoins. This is a very accomplished technologist, because his computer was heating up too much. So the work, even in those very first few months that it took from a computer to create coins, was terrific. And then
complicated algorithms.
Complicated. And the lots of people early on went out and spent, I don't know, you know, how many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars on computers ratcheting up, having computer farms in search of the Bitcoins. So if this still doesn't make sense to you, that's what people did. It's a big game.
I would say so. And you're listening to 105.1 WBNH, and our guest today is Sharon Sargent. She is an investigative reporter and helped identify the inventor, or the alleged inventor, of Bitcoin. And we're here today talking about that story and also a little bit about the story of Bitcoin and blockchain. So,
yeah, the blockchain is key for Bitcoin remaining at the top of the heap with all the proliferation of cryptocurrencies. But one of the things that's really interesting is how other people are looking at applications for the blockchain, particularly in the areas of security. And security today is just a total disaster. Security doesn't exist on any meaningful level.
Oh, boy.
It's terrible.
That's a glum
statement, and scary, too, because, well, we're all out there.
Right. Well, and we're all out there on the internet, mm-hmm. in electronic exchanges, in databases.
Mm-hmm.
And the compromised databases are, actually, I just got a notification from WordPress where I have an old blog. And they said, we advise you to reset your password because we found it, WordPress found it on a database that was in that, what they call the
dark web.
The dark web. I was going to call it the black web, but the dark web is the common term. Yeah.
Yeah. So my understanding of, and I really would love to explore a little bit this idea that you're bringing up. My understanding is that some people in Silicon Valley are looking at applications of blockchain to help actually offset a little bit of this fake news that we hear so much about, in the context of, if somebody posts a story, somebody else can't take credit for it. And people wouldn't be able to spoof you because the blockchain would guarantee traceability and auditability. And that would also apply to things like intellectual property. There'd be no question as to who the first publisher of something was, whether it be a photograph or something else, because the blockchain, because you're dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of computers that have to perfectly agree, even one disagreement will invalidate the transaction and will show it's not legitimate. This is a little bit of, you know, my very basic understanding of this technology, how it's being used.
Yeah, I haven't kept up with all of the, you know, the proposed applications, but the blockchain, whether you agree with cryptocurrencies or not, the blockchain concept is taking on a much larger life, and it's much needed because we have such horrible, you know, security and validation problems in terms of, and even back when I was investigating the Holocaust frauds, the planting of, you know, what they call trolls on the internet, planting of misinformation was going on then, but it wasn't so much the robots and the worms and, you know, all the techniques for doing it today.
So you have just explained a little bit about the mining.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that, I'll say, my son can buy a Bitcoin? He's not mining it. He just, is it on the open exchange now? Is that?
Your son can go to a Bitcoin exchange,
right,
and give them $10,000, $20,000, but you can buy pieces of Bitcoins too.
Yeah, I think he's buying pieces. He's buying a full Bitcoin. But and is that supported by our banking system? I mean, they're sending the money somewhere. Some money's changing hands here.
Right, and that's where in the U.S. at least the IRS comes into play. So there's all kinds of things going on with the IRS tracking Bitcoin exchanges and so on. And there's been, because the marketplaces have had all kinds of fraud, there are other legal aspects that come in to the, you know, the money aspect. So there are laws in place that have to do with monetary transactions that apply once Bitcoins are exchanged for not just money, but goods and services. I think the first product bought by a Bitcoin was a slice of pizza. So, and it was like, so it established the idea that somebody who had bitcoins and somebody who made pizza were willing to negotiate and an exchange for, and I don't remember how many bitcoins it was, a slice of pizza. So you can say, well, that sounds silly. Well, it wasn't too many years ago that people were buying luxury homes with bitcoins. So you have high-end people who are willing to take the risk that they will sell, you know, a valuable property for bitcoins. So this has been going on for, you know, I think about 2011 was when things really started to heat up. There was another fellow involved early on who did a lot of cleanup in the administrative side with the code generation for the blockchain in Finland. And he didn't stay in too long because he got interested in other things. So he got interested because it was an interesting concept. He got interested in other things, and he bought himself a nice condo in Finland.
Nice.
And that was very early on.
Let me pick up on another point that Andrea just made, which is, in some sense, the cryptocurrency network bypassed the banking system. I know, for example, that it takes somewhere in the area of less than a minute for a Bitcoin transaction to take place anywhere in the world. So I can exchange money with somebody in Turkey or Argentina or whatever. You put that in contrast to an ACH transfer in a bank that takes 24 to 72 hours. You're denied the use of your money because the bank is holding onto your money and putting it to work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this intermediatizing. It's getting rid of the bank in the middle as a trusted point of transaction connecting to people that's now being done in an automated manner through computers as opposed through the banking institution. Is that?
Yeah, that's fairly accurate. But it, one thing that is part of, at least in the U.S., the banking systems, their legacy systems slow things down. So they have legacy software that all the new stuff is piled on top of. And so you can, for example, lose track of a transaction that occurred on a Saturday of a long weekend until Wednesday. It's not accessible, or at least this was true 10 years ago. And the reason I know that was because I was a victim of identity theft, and someone went to my bank on a Saturday morning and took out almost $10,000, not $10,000, so they knew what they were doing, dollars in cash. And I couldn't get the bank to be able to do anything until Wednesday because it was a holiday weekend. So that's when I learned all about what's going on under the covers in the, you know, the banking system. But one of the issues, and I think this is, people are starting to become more aware of it, is all the intermediary fees are increasing. So what you're getting as time goes on is more of the same problems that you have with the central banking system. So the, you know, the cryptocurrencies are not immune to centuries of, you know, money exchange problems. And that seems to be, you know, much more awareness now. But people are still, like, you know, psyched to be trading cryptocurrencies.
Is there a management infrastructure to the exchange? Is there a, I mean, I don't know anything about the Bitcoin exchange, but is there like an overseer, a president, a CEO?
Well, the marketplaces have been constructed in various ways, and they have been subject to fraud, both from founders, you know, and from being compromised from the outside.
But the blockchain is like the internet. There's no one supra.
Right.
It's not a hierarchical system. It's a peer system.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And that what that means is that's why you have to have your concurrence with all these computers that are, you know, maintaining the integrity of the blockchain. They have to all agree. But what's very interesting is what the potential is with losing net neutrality. Because now you don't have, as Don was just saying, nobody controls the internet. Well, you know, there are protocols and, you know, and all of that. And because in my early days of working on internet protocols, I worked on transmission queuing in routers. So lots of different internet routers and how they balance, load balance, traffic coming in from all different places is already very complicated. But now with the idea that you're going to be billing people differently for different traffic, I think my phone company, I think, is already fiddling with that. Because I use my phone for a hotspot.
What you just talked about, is that part of the discussion about stock trades and how fast the trade can get, milliseconds? Are we talking milliseconds?
Well, what you're talking about, it's different. Don talked about that as an advantage. You can get these Bitcoin trades much quicker than you can through the banking system. But in the stock trades or in the
commodity trades derivatives.
Yeah. I mean, all these things that are based on numbers, you know, in other words, speed and calculation combinations have been manipulated. So you've seen the stock markets go through various types of rules as to, you know, what kind of trading can go on and what's manipulative.
Net neutrality, that would also impact the speed at which certain trades are placed. Might it impact it?
Well, yes.
And so Bitcoin, as it is on the exchange, when you go to buy some, I mean, that it would be subject to that too. You know, I just have to, because I'm a very concrete thinker, exactly. I view this whole discussion about Bitcoin as, do you know sparrows? Have you ever seen sparrows flock or starlings?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Starlings.
Like lemmings.
Swarms. They're like swarms.
Yeah. And they seem to rise and fall on some collective, they swarm with a collective consciousness. I feel like this Bitcoin is a little bit like that, where it could go up and then down. And I don't know. I have a very hard time making it a concrete discussion.
I think your visual metaphor is really what's been happening. So that it makes sense that's the way that you understand it. Stock markets are like that.
Right.
I would like to, just because we're starting to get close to the end of the show, I think it's important to finish the story of what you did with Newsweek, why it's controversial, and what you concluded. By the way, we're listening here on 105.1 WBNH Business IQ Radio. You're listening to Don Byrne and Andrea O'Brien. And our guest today is an extremely knowledgeable investigative journalist and forensic genealogist, Sharon Sargent, who is involved and is about, hopefully, to tell us the rest of the story about an investigation conducted by Newsweek that tried to unmask the developer of the blockchain and subsequently the use of it with Bitcoin. So can you pick up, sir? I mean, what we heard was that you were engaged with the reporter. I think her name is Ms. Goodman.
Right.
And what happened? Because I know it was controversial, and Andrea raised the question with somebody's life. I know that, you know, there have been death threats issued to the people, perhaps yourself, but certainly to the reporter.
Yeah, the reporter got that. I mean, my children were concerned that I would get those kinds of, you know, threats. And
So why? What happened? What did you find out?
Well, first of all, why would Dorian Nakamoto deny such a thing? And it's the threats, it's the visibility and other factors, which has to do with his personal life. But the fact of the matter is, how did he end up with these gifted bitcoins from everybody who sympathized with him? Because they believed that they believed so much in the Bitcoin and the concept and everything that they wanted to do something. They were mixed. Either he was the real Satoshi Nakamoto, or he was being doxed, as they say, by Newsweek. But here's the thing. Those enthusiasts are really rabid in their belief of in the concept of Bitcoin and so on, and choose to ignore the data points that we had with Dorian Nakamoto and put them together. They don't want to believe it. But the controversy continues. We had the dump file from the very first exchange with Hal Finney, which proved that Satoshi Nakamoto that included an exchange with Hal Finney was just a few miles away. News reports get it wrong. It wasn't a few blocks. They didn't live in the same town.
You're talking about the IP address showing.
That's right. Yeah. The IP address. And that was one thing. But at the end, after we did all of the, like I got naturalization papers that showed the trail of what his name was. Ms. Goodman interviewed his family and lots of pieces that came together. And when she went to interview him, he admitted in front of the police. He called the police because he didn't want her there. He called the police and she said, I just want to talk to you, you know, about Bitcoin. And he said in front of the police, I'm no longer involved. And those were his exact words. Now, afterwards to the press, and the police confirmed this, because then there was all this furor about Ms. Goodman, you know, isn't reporting what he said. No, the police, you know, confirmed that's exactly what he said. So that was the, you know, the clincher. That's when she decided to go with the story, because we had so much else, leading up to it. But it's still a controversy. And it's still the fact that the original blockchain bitcoins are sitting there untraded also is a risk for Bitcoin holders. You know, so
a risk why?
A risk because if they flood the market,
if they find these original coins,
if those coins come out of, in other words, if the key, the cryptocurrency key, still exists and they can be traded, it will flood the market. And that is, despite the fact that there's a fixed number of Bitcoins that can happen, it would completely change the, you know, the landscape.
Yeah, it's like having a rare stamp, and suddenly you find out instead of you having the only one, there's 100 of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know stamp collectors.
I get stamp collecting down pat. I'm still confused as to where the money goes. Like, where does the money go?
The money, now
is it just out there with, like, where does it go?
The first product transaction was the slice of pizza.
Right.
So people either create Bitcoins or buy them in speculation of the increase in value.
So I want to buy one. So I'll transfer money to who?
An exchange. A Bitcoin exchange that will sell, just like a coin exchange.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it would be like going to a bank with a check.
Or going to a coin dealer and saying, I want to buy a gold coin because I think gold is going to increase in value.
So somebody made an effort to set up an exchange where this money is deposited. And there must be a bank that services that. Is there no bank that services that?
Oh, banks, credit cards, all kinds of financial institutions are actually either accepting Bitcoins, trading. In other words, it is not just in these rogue, you know, kinds of exchanges.
So
what happens is you come to me with $10,000 and you say, I want a Bitcoin. I send you a code that you then put on a computer that you then probably take off the internet so it can't be hacked, and you've got locked away with a password. And that is the code that represents a Bitcoin. Meanwhile, I take your $10,000 and I go spend it.
Right.
Yeah. So I go spend it. And what I can do with that $10,000 is whatever I want to do with it.
Right.
And I can do that. It used to be there were these exchanges that were not monitored by people like Silk Road, right, where I could do that stuff. And that's where people were exchanging drugs and they were doing ransomware and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So that was the whole idea was that, you know, I was sure I was going to get my transaction because that's what the blockchain ensured. But I also knew that I could do it anonymously. And because I'm doing anonymously, that's the attractiveness.
Is it anonymous now? No.
No, it is anonymous. It is anonymous in that the ledger is open, but the ledger does not.
The IP addresses are in the ledger.
Something's
in the ledger.
It's not. What it is, it's the.
The confirmation.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
There's an address of some type for you.
Okay. Now, there are records of addresses, and I did track this. To a certain extent, manually. You can do it now with tools that tell you what IP address a transaction originated at and where it ended. And that's how people who are writing all about Dorian Nakamoto's $270,000 exchange last summer, they can follow the transactions, which has its quirks, too, in terms of, what he was doing. They can follow where the transactions went because that is in the ledger.
So I have a question. So let's say there is and this is speculation. I mean, I'm interested to know what you think will happen. There's a world event, a cataclysmic world event. Are we going to all flock to Bitcoin or is Bitcoin going to go down the tubes? What do you think?
Well, if I knew the answer to that.
well, what we don't know is will there, you know, if and when there'll be the cataclysmic event, but. On one hand, people are going to want to eat and drink and that's could be its own. I guess what I'm thinking about is gold.
Yeah.
Gold is always seems to be the thing you want to have in the event that everything goes south. But is that maybe Bitcoin is what you...
Yeah, can Bitcoin protect wealth?
I don't know. Gold is so different because gold has value in and of itself. It has utilitarian, mm-hmm. you know, value, and that's how it became mm-hmm. A standard,
well,
I think.
I mean, it used to be salt. I mean, gold, right. It's sure. just random that we pick right. gold. Yeah.
There are, by the way, cryptocurrencies backed by salt.
There are.
Yeah. That I mean, the part of what people are speculating is that, and we're almost at the end of the show here, that people have to, that there may be some developments such as a bank or a country, think China, may come out and say, we are going to support a cryptocurrency and we're going to back it with gold. And mm-hmm. we'll have a limited number of these coins that we'll create or this mm-hmm. limited amount to the currency, but it'll be backed. But the speculation will then take off and it'll always have some inherent value because of right. the exchange. The whole thing comes down to the exchangeability of it.
Right.
Right. The liquidity of it.
That's
if it
right.
doesn't have any liquidity, it's exactly what you're speculating on. It's so much air.
So it's so much air. So if something horrible happens and we lose the ability to communicate on the internet or whatever,
right.
it could be that
coronal mass ejection takes down the internet.
Right.
Right? Big EMP. Right.
Then Bitcoin goes poof. I don't know.
Well, it depends if your computer is protected or not and if they ever get it back and whether it's it. So many questions. But a fascinating show and something we certainly haven't done a lot to complete. Sharon, why don't you just tell us if people wanted to reach out to you and find out more about your forensic genealogy work or whatever, what's the best place for them to contact you or how could they contact you?
Well, the best way to contact me is through email at and it's ancestral. Manor, ancestralmanor @gmail.com.
Very, very good. You've really done a good job here of covering a big complex topic with a couple of novice people here. And I have a little bit of a better understanding of what I know is confounding a lot of people. So we may have to have you back to do a part two of this and understand
yeah.
it some
Thank
more.
Thank you. Yeah, likewise.
Well, there's so much going on, and I'm sure there'll be more happening. It's like
it's changing quickly.
Yes.
I feel like it's really in shifting sands here.
Your analogy to the birds.
The starlings, right.
The starlings is like, it is, it's moving like that.
Right.
It's fascinating.
Very, very fluid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we'd like to wish everybody, thank you all for listening here to Business IQ Radio on 105.1. And we will turn, as we do every week, to Andrea to give us our sign off. And Andrea, do you have some advice for the Business IQ listeners?
I do. And I want to also thank Sharon for taking the time to speak with us. And so I'll just say this to our listening audience. You can spend more than you make, but you can only do it for so long.